So now we're finally into a chapter that's not all over the place. For the rest of the chapters will be much more focused, including this next one, which is about chemistry. And in fact, the whole term is really largely about chemistry. This is just as much a chemistry course as it is a biology course because of what 181 is compared to 182. 181 is cellular biology. And what happens inside cells is chemistry, the chemistry of life. So it's not only about chemical reactions, which are processes, metabolism, but it's also about the chemicals themselves, because what occurs inside a cell is microscopic, atoms and molecules. Okay, now the photographs that you see here, notice, have symbols in between them. This is a photographic representation of a chemical reaction. And the arrow that you see here kind of shows you that this is a chemical reaction. Typically, we don't use photographs to illustrate a chemical reaction, but this one just does. Usually, it's chemical formulae that we see, symbols for chemicals. But any given chemical reaction's portrayal, whichever method we use, will have an arrow separating some number of things on the left from some number of things on the right. So in any given chemical reaction, there is some number of things on the left, which collectively are called reactants. Those are substances that you start with before the reaction occurs. And it doesn't have to be two. There just happen to be two reactants in this example. It can be one or more. And then on the right side of the arrow, the arrow indicates the actual progress of the reaction. On the right side of that is some number, one or more, not necessarily one like in this case, one or more substances collectively called products. So, in any given chemical reaction, some number of reactants are transformed into some number of products. That's an important thing about any chemical reaction. You end up with different stuff than you had to begin with. And what's remarkable about this is that no material is added or subtracted in the process. All material objects, all substances included, substances are just chemicals, but chemicals are materials. They're made of matter. All material objects in the universe are made of particles that we'll be talking much more about, which are atoms. And when a chemical reaction occurs, you change the stuff you have. The reactants, in other words, however many there are different from, the products are different from the reactants that you started with. But not because anything is added or subtracted in the process. It is simply a rearrangement of the particles that all of these things are made out of. A rearrangement of atoms. And that simple rearrangement can make a huge difference with respect to the properties of these substances. And this is a good example to illustrate how profound a change it can occur. On the left, on the reactants side here, we have two reactants. One of them is a metal. Sodium is a metal. And each of these two reactants in this example happen to be elements, so they're on the periodic table. Sodium is right here. Of course, it has the symbol Na. I say that facetiously, but it does make sense. Because another name for sodium is natrium. That's why it's Na. And chlorine is also an element, Cl over there. It's number 17. Well, these are not only elements, but they are really dangerous elements. Sodium is a metal, but more specifically, it is a very, very highly reactive metal that you do not want to touch. Sodium will kill you because it reacts so violently with the moisture in your skin, which is why this person is loved holding this chunk. You would never want to do that with bare hands. So this is stuff you do not want to be around. Chlorine is a poisonous gas when it's by itself. It is also very highly reactive and will kill your cells, which is why we use a very, very dilute form of it in pools to kill the things in pools. We just don't use enough to kill you. So pure chlorine, you don't want to have any part of that either. Either of these two reactants is deadly. But when you get them together and just let the particles that they're made out of rearrange themselves, you make a compound. This product happens to be a compound. It's not an element. You're not going to find it on the periodic table of the elements because it's a combination of elements, which is what a compound is. Anyway, the specific compound, as you see, is sodium chloride, which is an example of a salt. Usually when we use the word salt, we're referring to table salt, which is exactly what sodium chloride is. It's table salt. But that's just one of all kinds of different possible salts. All right. Well, not only is sodium chloride not going to kill you, like sodium and chlorine do, but you also can't live without it. So you turn two deadly things into something that you can't live without simply by slightly rearranging the particles they're made out of. That's a profound change. And that's a chemical reaction. That's just one representation of it. But before we leave this example, since I've used some terms, let me define those a little better. I mentioned that sodium and chlorine are elements, and elements are specific kinds of substances. Substances is a much more general term. There's no limit to the number of substances or chemicals that can be produced. Almost all of those, though, are compounds. Compounds are substances that are made up of two or more elements, like sodium chloride being made up of sodium and chlorine. Elements, though, are not made up. That's why I used the analogy last week, using elements as fundamental and derived, between fundamental and derived. Compounds are like derived, and elements are like fundamental. But what, more specifically, how would you define an element? What is it that actually makes an element an element? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right, but what do you mean by purest form? I mean, you can have very, very pure sodium chloride, but that doesn't make it an element. Yeah.
They're not formed with other elements?
Yes, that's true, but unless you know what an element is to begin with, then that definition doesn't help you, right? We're trying to define element, so you can't use element in the definition. Yeah.
Single atoms?
I'll accept single type of atom, yes. An element is a substance made up of only one kind of atom, whereas a compound is made up of at least two different kinds of atoms, maybe more. And so there's already millions of compounds that we as humans have produced on Earth, and there's no limit. But there's only roughly 100 elements. And getting them together in different ways is how there's no limit to the number of compounds, which are most of the substances. All right, now I'll be saying much more about the periodic table and elements to begin with. I just wanted to quickly define those. Let's look at some other representations of chemical reactions in slide, what is that, 3 or 2? 2. On the top one, we're using cartoons. On the bottom, this is how most chemical reactions are depicted, as on the bottom, with chemical formulae using letters and numbers. This is the same reaction in both cases. In cartoon form, it shows you the atoms involved. So you start with hydrogen molecules, oxygen molecule, and make water molecules. Water has properties that neither of those two reactants have. So you're making new stuff, but not because you're adding or subtracting any atoms, you're just rearranging them. All right, let's go on to three. This is a table of elements in your body as a human. But really, even though the numbers would be slightly different for other organisms, this goes for nearly all organisms, not just animals, which humans are examples of, not just humans, pretty much all organisms, especially when it comes to these top four. Now, the oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen make up most of you in terms of your collection of atoms. And atoms are truly tiny things, by the way. We've been talking about how many cells you're made up of, right? 100 trillion, roughly, for your body. And so it's kind of hard to imagine a cell. It's so small when it's 1/100 trillionth of you. But as small as one cell is, it has many millions of atoms in that one cell. So they are very, very tiny. And if you just think of yourself not as cells, but as a collection of a hell of a lot of atoms, most of those atoms are oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And notice that those occur near the top of the periodic table. Hydrogen here, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in the second row. Now, every organism must have those four in them, and plenty of them. And that's largely because of the macromolecules that we talked a little bit about before. Do you remember what the four categories of biological macromolecules are? Now, you shouldn't look at your notes here because you can't look at your notes on the day of the test. And if you have to now, then it shows that you are disobeying me and that you're falling behind in the course. You have to take this stuff a little bit at a time and study it each night. So who can tell me what they are without looking? Yeah. Nucleic acids, lipids, polypeptides, and polysaccharides. Good. Well, all four of those categories have oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen in them. Plus, you find these atoms in smaller molecules as well, like water. Water is a lot of you. And two of those categories, in addition to the three that I just mentioned, oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen, two of them have also nitrogen in them. And those two are the polypeptides and the nucleic acids. It's impossible to think of any organism without having the macromolecules that organisms are built of, which is why it's not just humans that have these four, it's all organisms. And that makes up most of you, about 96% of you. But we can't live with just those. There's other elements that are necessary, some of them in trace amounts on the bottom shown here, and several of them that we need a fair amount of, but not nearly as much as carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen. So you can't live without these other ones for various reasons, but as far as the periodic table of the elements is concerned, all of these ones that are listed in the top two that make up most of an organism are found near the top of the periodic table. Well, the periodic table is not a random listing of elements. It's an ordered listing, and the order, you can see it, there's order because of the blue numbers here. The blue number for each element, it's not always blue, it is in this version of periodic table. The blue integer is called the atomic number. The periodic table lists all of the elements in order of atomic number. But what is the atomic number? What does that tell you? There's exactly one thing that the atomic number tells you. Does anyone know? Yes. Everyone hear that? Of course not, because you're not talking as loudly as I am. So say it proudly when you're correct. What is it?
The amount of protons.
Yes, the number of protons And that's it. That's all the atomic number is. So before, when I said that an element is a substance that contains only one kind of atom, that statement implies that there's different kinds of atoms, right? But it's not because the atoms are different in terms of particles that they're made of, because as tiny as atoms are, they're made of even smaller things. That's not what... It's not that they're different kinds of particles, but what makes an element a specific element and not another element is the particular number of protons, and that's what the atomic number is. So a hydrogen atom is hydrogen only because it has exactly one proton. That's what the one tells you. If you have two protons, you're not a hydrogen atom, you're a helium atom. Element number two. Okay, that's what the atomic number tells us. And therefore, since as we go through the table, we're involving more and more protons, that means the top elements, or the ones near the top of the table, are smaller and lighter. Those are the ones that organisms are mostly made out of. As you get farther and farther down into the heavier elements, they become, for various reasons, dangerous to life, actually. And so these things near the bottom are things that you don't want in your body or that will kill you. But anyway, that's one thing about the periodic table. Another is that, of course, being a table, it's made up of rows and columns, except we shouldn't really call them rows and columns, even though I already have. The rows in a periodic table are called periods, and the columns are called groups. More about that when we get more deeply into the atom. Speaking of the atom, slide 4 shows you a cartoon version of one. Now, what kind of atom is this? What element is this? It's helium, because it has two protons. And that's the only thing that makes something helium. Doesn't matter how many of the other kinds of particles that we still haven't talked about. It's only the protons that matter for the element type. Well, atoms that we've already established are almost inconceivably tiny, but they are made of even tinier things, which, since they are smaller than the atom itself, are called collectively subatomic particles. And if this were not a biology course but a physics course, you would learn that these even tinier than an atom subatomic particles that I'm about to talk about are themselves made of even smaller things. But that's beyond the realm of biology. It doesn't really matter to biology so much. Anyway, we're going to talk about the three primary subatomic particles. There are three categories. And as you see in the cartoon here, those categories are protons, neutrons, and electrons. And there's several reasons why this cartoon is actually false, other than just that they're not really pink and yellow and whatnot. There's more important reasons why this is a lie. But it's actually kind of constructive to keep this mental idea, just so that you can keep things straight as to where these particles are. Protons and neutrons have something in common, a couple things in common. One is their size, or their mass. Remember that mass is the amount of material in something. Notice that they're drawn, the brown neutrons are drawn the same size as the magenta protons. It's actually not the case that they're exactly the same mass. Protons and neutrons are not quite exactly equal sized, but it's really, really close. All right? That's something that they kind of have in common, but there's a fundamental difference between the two, and that is that neutrons, as their name indicates, are electrically neutral, meaning they do not have an electrostatic charge. They're not charged. A proton, on the other hand, basically as big, almost exactly the same size as a neutron, is a charged particle. And as you see by the pluses in the magenta-colored protons, each proton has a positive one charge. All right. Now, one important part of the mistruth of this cartoon version is that while it is true, as this indicates, that electrons are smaller than protons and neutrons, they're actually much smaller than this indicates. These electrons are drawn way bigger than they actually are in comparison to the size of protons and neutrons. So that part's wrong, but they would be drawn so small that you wouldn't be able to see them very easily. Now, despite this huge disparity in size between an electron and a proton, electrons are also charged, and the magnitude of their charge, which is negative for an electron as opposed to positive for a proton, that magnitude, the size of that charge, is just as big as the size of the charge of the proton, even though the electron is tiny in size. So the negative one charge of an electron is exactly equal, but in the opposite direction, equal in size, but in the opposite direction to a positive one of a proton. Which means if you have one of each, or any number of each, if it's the same number, 20 and 20, 1 and 1, whatever, then when you add up all the charges, it'll add up to zero, right? Despite the fact that most of the mass is in protons, not in electrons, because of the size difference. And that's true in something that we call an atom. Usually when we use the word atom, it's kind of shorthand for the phrase neutral atom. A neutral atom means that it doesn't, as an overall atom, have any charge. It's made up of charged particles, protons and electrons, but since there's an equal number of both of those oppositely charged particles, the overall charge is zero. That's a neutral atom. All right? Now, neutrons do not have to be present. A proton, at least one proton, has to be present or you don't have an atom. And that's why protons are such a big deal about the element types. Another thing that's different about these subatomic particles is that protons and neutrons occur only in a cluster at the center of the atom that we call the nucleus. And that's an entirely different use of the word nucleus compared to one that I've already told you about, which is a cell nucleus. A eukaryotic cell, by definition, has a cell nucleus, right? But a cell nucleus is enormous compared to an atomic nucleus. There are millions and millions and millions of atoms just in one nucleus of a cell. So the atomic nucleus is truly tiny. But the atomic nucleus is simply the total number of protons and neutrons, however many there are there for that atom, in that atom. That's the only place that you'll find protons and neutrons. There has to be at least one proton. There can be more, of course, for other elements besides hydrogen. There doesn't have to be any neutrons, but there sometimes are. So an atomic nucleus is one or more protons and zero or more neutrons, and that's it. No electrons. Electrons are not found in the nucleus, in other words. Electrons are found somewhere outside of the nucleus. And that's another part of why this cartoon is a lie. This yellow circle pretends that these electrons are circling in an orbit around the nucleus, kind of like satellites do around a star. That's not the truth. It's okay if you want to memorize it that way, but that's really not what's happening. For reasons that are beyond the scope of this course, we actually can't predict with certainty where electrons are at any given moment. We just know that they are at any given moment somewhere in the space around the nucleus. Okay? Let's go on to 5. We have the same lying cartoon in B that we just looked at, but A is a little bit closer to the truth because this one does not show electrons orbiting the nucleus. It doesn't show any discrete electrons. It just shows this yellowness. This yellowness represents an electron cloud, which indicates it's really just a probability space. What that means is that where the yellow is more rich or more yellowish, that's a region that we know mathematically there's a higher chance of finding electrons. And as it fades out to whiteness, the probability of finding electrons there, which is still possible, it's just not as probable. So electrons are somewhere in the electron cloud, which is the space around the nucleus. All right. Now on to 6. It's time now to talk about some spaces. And it's a nested arrangement of spaces. So I'm going to talk about spaces inside of spaces inside of spaces. None of these spaces is material. It's just a space that can be occupied. All right, now I'm going to give you the bigger spaces first, because that's the slide we're on, 6. We have some sort of atom here. We don't know what kind because we don't see any detail in the nucleus. There's an atomic nucleus, though, at the center. And then illustrated by these circles in yellow, which is just a cartoon rendition, are spaces that are called either levels or energy levels or electron shells or simply shells. All 4 of those names are interchangeable, really. Usually, just because it's hard to say the whole phrase, we either say level or shell. All right? Now, the word shell kind of says that it's made of something. It's not a material, it's just a space. All right? But they're called energy levels, these shells, because there's energy associated with each one. And notice it's a concentric arrangement. So there is a level that's closest to the nucleus. That's the lowest energy level. And as you get to levels that are farther from the nucleus, there is more energy associated with those levels. Now, these are spaces, as I said, but what occupy these spaces, or what can occupy them, are electrons. This is part of the electron cloud we just mentioned. And what this says, but the arrows, is that to have an electron be at a higher energy level means that energy has to be supplied in order to make that happen. And for an electron to drop to a lower energy level, energy gets lost in that process. Now, this will be important a bit later after I'm done talking about these spaces, but that's why they're called energy levels. Another important part of this slide, though, is that any given electron can occupy one level or another. It can't be in between, though. That's what the stair step analogy is all about. If you went through with this experiment and rolled a ball from the top of the stairs, it might go all the way down, but it's possible that it would run out of energy and stop on one of the individual steps, not all the way down, right? It's never, though, going to hang between steps. And similarly, an electron is in one level or another, not a combination of the two. Okay, so they're discrete or separate from each other. Now, in 7, I need to continue this discussion of the spaces. And I said they're nested, spaces within spaces within spaces. Kind of like that you find in a house. If you ignore the actual structure, the walls of the house, and just consider the space, the biggest space is the house itself, which is made up of smaller spaces that we call rooms, right? And rooms can be have smaller spaces in them called closets. That's kind of what we're talking about here. Spaces within bigger spaces within bigger spaces. I've already mentioned the biggest of the three spaces. Those are the levels or shells. Okay, now each level, and by the way, the levels are numbered. 1 for the lowest one, closest to the nucleus, 2 is the next, 3, and so on. Each shell, though, or level, which is the big space, is made up of some number of smaller spaces or subspaces called subshells, which makes sense as a word. They're part of the shell. And so the subshells would be like the rooms. Each subshell is made up of some number of subspaces within it called orbitals. So the orbitals are kind of like the closets in that analogy. It's all spaces, though. And it's all spaces in which electrons can occur. In the cartoon in slide 7, we can see some orbitals drawn here in yellow. Unfortunately, it's all yellow, so it's harder to talk about than if they use other colors. But notice that there is a smaller circle here. It's kind of a darker yellow. That smaller circle is one orbital. It's an individual orbital. But it's a specific category of orbitals. There are different categories of orbitals. Each category has its own shape. The ones that are spherical, and the smallest one is spherical. It looks like a circle, but it's really a sphere in 3 dimensions. That specifically is called an S orbital. And you can think of S as meaning spherical. That helps you remember it. All right? Now, this bigger sphere is also an S orbital. But the bigger sphere is an S orbital that's in a different level. So the small sphere, using the house analogy, would be a closet in one house. This bigger one is a closet in a bigger house. There are also P orbitals. This, what I'm tracing here, looks like an infinity symbol when I'm tracing it, is a single P orbital. But notice here's another P orbital, and here's another P orbital. They have a different shape compared to S orbitals. All right. Every level, or shell, has in it an S orbital. And we number orbitals with the number of the level they're in. So this small sphere would specifically be called the 1s orbital. 1 meaning it's in shell 1 or level 1. The next level up, which is level 2, has its own s orbital. That's called the 2s. And so on. I need to talk about level two before I talk again about level one, because it'll be more confusing if I go in order of levels. Level two has its own S orbital, the 2S, this bigger circle, bigger sphere. But starting with level two and up, two, three, and up, each level has, in addition to an S orbital, three distinct P orbitals. Notice that you see three P orbitals here. All three of those P orbitals are part of level two. Level one does not have any P orbitals. Levels two and above do. All right? Now, armed with that knowledge, I can talk more about subshells. What makes something a subshell is that it is made up of all of the orbitals of the same category within that same level. For instance, this single S orbital that we call the 1S, that's all of the S orbitals that are in that level. And so that single S orbital makes up what's called the S subshell of level 1. Level 2 has an S subshell as well that's made up of all the S orbitals that are in level 2, which is just this one orbital that we call the 2S. But level 2 also has another subshell called the P subshell. And the P subshell contains all of the P orbitals in that level. Well, there's three P orbitals, but they're the same category, so they all belong to the same subshell within that level. Does that all make sense? I'm going to take silence as meaning yes, so I think it really means no when you're not telling me that it makes sense. And that can be dangerous. So you want to stick with the silence as an answer? Yeah.
So when you say, and sorry, this probably sounds like a dumb question, but when you say the P orbital, what on that dot?
This, what I'm tracing here, just this one, that is an orbital.
Okay.
That's a P orbital, but so is this. And so is this. What makes them all p orbitals is that they're that shape.
Right. So when you say it's occupied by two, would that, like, so you said that 1s is not occupied by any orbitals, correct?
No, I said that 1s is the name of this particular s orbital that's
right
in the first level.
Yes.
And that there's only one of them. There's in every level contains only a single S orbital.
Okay.
And so every level, because it has S orbitals, every level has an S subshell in it. But for every level, the S subshell is made up of only one orbital, because there's only one S type orbital in each shell. For levels 2 and above, in addition to having an S subshell, there is one P subshell. There's no P subshell in level 1 because level 1 doesn't have P's. The single P subshell that's in level 2 that we're looking at here contains all of the P category orbitals. That's what makes it a subshell. It contains all of the orbitals of the same category within that one level.
So if there were a third shell,
yeah,
that would be 3S, because there would be another.
That's right. And it would have its own three P's that make up the P subshell in level 3.
Right.
Plus, it would have five D orbitals that are a different shape still, and we're not looking at those.
Mm-hmm.
And so, first level contains 1S orbital, which also makes up the entire subshell called the S subshell. And this is why level 1 is tricky. We're calling it three different things. The entire level is the same thing as the S subshell, which is the same thing as the 1S orbital, because it's just one space within the same space within the same space. for that level one. But in level two, we have how many orbitals? No? I'm hearing a lot of integers. Haven't heard the right one yet. No, there's five shown in this picture. But this smaller circle, that's level one. No, it's four, yes. Four. Level two has a single 2s orbital, and it has three different 2p's. By the way, the p's, you don't see it exactly. You have to think about this in perspective. It's a two-dimensional drawing. But the three p orbitals are arranged mutually orthogonally, which simply means that each p orbital is at right angles to the other two. And so they correspond to x, y, and z on a three-dimensional graph. All right? Two of them would be like this, and then the third one would be like this. Each of them is at right angles to the other two. And that's why we can't just call them all three of them 2p's. We say 2px, 2py, 2pz. Okay, so we'd start with level 2 because it's easier. Level 2 is all of this. That's the house. It has two subshells, an S subshell and a P subshell. Those are the rooms. The S subshell is made up of all the S orbitals. Well, there's only one in it. But the P orbitals, there's three of, and so there's three P orbitals making up the P subshell. All right, those are like the closets. The orbitals are like the closets. Level one is confusing, though, because the orbital is the same as the subshell, which is the same as the overall level. Does that help? Let's look at it drawn differently in slide 8 from the book. Here we have the same picture on the bottom, but it's deconstructed here above that. So you can see the 1s orbital makes up the entire S subshell of the first level, which also makes up the entire shell or level. The second level has four overall orbitals, a single 2s and three different 2p's, but they're arranged in categories. The S goes into the makes up the S subshell of level 2. All three of the p's go into the P subshell of level 2. And the combination of those two subshells, an S subshell and a P subshell, make up the entire second level or second shell. Now, I still haven't told you something very important about an orbital. And this applies to any type orbital. Any individual orbital can contain at most 2 electrons. Which means that there are 3 possibilities for any given orbital. The 3 possibilities are that it contains 0 electrons, 1 electron, or 2 electrons, right? No other possibilities. And the filling of these orbitals is really important to chemistry, including the reaction that we've already looked at, for stability reasons, energetic stability reasons. In slide 9, we're looking at just an abbreviated version of the periodic table. This doesn't list all of them, it's just the first few periods. By the way, each period, which is, remember, a row in the periodic table, represents a shell, 1 energy level. So this is the first shell, this is the second shell, this is the third shell, as you see, and so on down the periodic table. What is represented by these yellow circles in this figure? Yes, these each individual circle is a shell. Not the little dots. The little dots are what?
Electrons,
right. And the circles, you're correct in saying that those are shells. Now, they cannot possibly be orbitals. Why? How do you know just from looking at them that they're not orbitals, the circles? Oh, don't worry about the shape. Even though not all orbitals are circular, why is it also true that these can't possibly be depicting orbitals? For instance, why is this circle not an orbital, definitely?
Because it's smaller than the Earth. Like it's supposed to fit inside of it, not outside of it?
No. Right, it violates what I just told you. Can't possibly be an orbital because an orbital can't contain more than two electrons. So these are shells. The circle simply represents the concept of a shell. It has nothing to do with shape. And remember that a shell is made up of subshells, each of which is made up of orbitals. But think of that first shell. That's the one that I said is confusing because the overall shell is the same thing as the subshell, which is the same thing as the 1s orbital. Therefore, because of that, what is the total number of electrons that the first shell can hold? 2. Because the entire shell has only one orbital in it, the 1s. Okay? That's why there are only 2 elements in the first period. Because the first shell can hold only 2 electrons. Now, we've already said that really what defines these elements, the only thing that defines them is the number of protons, right? Hydrogen is hydrogen only because it has exactly one proton. But if we're talking about an atom, which is a neutral atom of hydrogen, then yes, of course, to be hydrogen, it has to have one proton, but to be neutral overall, it has to have one electron to counteract the positive proton that it has. Well, you have room for one electron in the first shell. Helium is helium because it has exactly 2 protons, but a neutral atom of helium, therefore, has 2 negative electrons as well. And you can fit 2 electrons in that orbital. But lithium, which is a metal, has 3 protons and therefore 3 electrons. That third electron can't fit in the orbital that makes up the first shell. That's why lithium has to be in the second period, because it has a non-empty second shell. Shells are just spaces, so we can number them whether there's any electrons there or not. But if there are no electrons at all in a shell, we just kind of ignore them. We only care about shells that have at least one electron in them. And lithium, therefore, has a second shell that's not empty because you have to put that third electron somewhere. Electrons, if you let me anthropomorphize them or give them human qualities, they want to be as low a shell as they can. Remember the energy levels with the arrows in that figure? Farther away from the nucleus takes more energy. So they want to be at the lowest energy level they can occupy. But they can't occupy it if all of the orbitals in that shell are already filled. That's why you have to put this electron in the second shell. Okay, now, helium is on the right edge of the periodic table. If you look at the whole one, you see more examples. All of those elements on the right edge are quite satisfied. And that's because what's true of all of those, and collectively they are called the noble gases. By the way, they're in the same group, right? Same column. In general, elements that are in the same group have similar properties with each other. So all of these noble gases that are on the right edge, those are, there's something special about them. They're very stable, which is why they don't want to take part in chemistry and rearrange their particles. They're already really stable as they are. And what gives them that stability is that they have an outer shell. By outer shell, I mean one that's not empty. An outer shell that is full, or at least a subshell in that outer shell that's full. That makes the atom very stable. All right, so helium is not going to react with things. It's going to stay as a helium atom, already very stable. All of the rest of the elements, everything to the left of that last group, are at least slightly dissatisfied because they're not as stable as these right edgers are. The noble gases are stable because of this outer shell being filled. And that's why chemistry happens. The rearrangement of particles that I said chemical reactions are is simply a way to make the stability greater for the atoms that are involved. When chemistry happens, the atoms become like one of these noble gases, in a sense, as far as their stability is concerned. Okay, now, I was thinking there was something else I wanted to say about this one, but I guess there isn't. Let me go on to 10. And now we need to... Oh, yes, there was one thing. I suddenly remember that usually happens. The periodic table, I used the word metal. The periodic table has roughly 100 naturally occurring elements and some ones that we've manufactured in laboratories, but they last only a tiny fraction of a second. Roughly 100 naturally occurring elements in the universe, though, and they're not equally represented. There's more than two, but there's two really major categories of elements, and those are metals and nonmetals. Well, except for the noble gases. The whole chart except the noble gases is broken into metals and nonmetals. But what I mean by not being equally represented is that there aren't all that many nonmetals. The nonmetals are in this triangle roughly right here. Those are the nonmetals of the world, the right edge, upper right edge. And, plus hydrogen. Hydrogen is also a nonmetal, even though it's over by itself. All the other ones, though, to the left of that triangle, except for hydrogen, are the metals. And it's important to realize the distinction here because of their placement on the periodic table, given what I've told you about stability of the right edge. Since the metals are the left side, that means their outer shell is more empty than full. As you see, let me momentarily go back to 9. These metals on the left are more empty in their outer shell than they are filled. Nonmetals, on the other hand, being right next door or two steps away or three from the right edge, their outer shells are more full than empty. Does this make sense to you? Now, the first period fills up with just two electrons, right? But the second period has how many orbitals? I mean the second shell, I'm sorry, but a period corresponds to a shell. How many orbitals in the second shell?
Four.
There's a single S called the 2S, and there are three different P's called 2PX, 2PY, 2PZ. Four overall, meaning the entire shell 2 can hold how many electrons maximally? No? Shell 2.
Eight.
And that's the basis of the so-called octet rule. 2 is the magic number for the first shell, but 8 for the second, because there's 4 orbitals available to fill. And so neon has 10 overall electrons, but what makes it stable is that shell 2, which is non-empty for it, is totally filled. Okay. Well, the nonmetals, which are almost to the right edge, are almost full in their outer shell, but not quite. That's what I meant by saying they're more full than they are empty in their outer shell. The metals, on the other hand, like lithium, it had to stick an electron into the second shell, right? So it has a second shell that's not empty, but it can hold seven more. Therefore, it's more empty than it is full. All of these things, except for the noble gases, are trying to be like noble gases to get that stability. But the nonmetals can do that more easily by taking on additional electrons, one or more, depending on how many steps away from the right edge they are. Metals, on the other hand, being more empty than full, can take on the stability of the right edge more easily by just getting rid of the electrons that are in the outer shell rather than adding a hell of a lot of them. Lithium can get rid of one instead of adding seven. Because if it gets rid of one electron, that second shell is empty and we don't even consider it to be a shell, right? Then its outer shell that's not empty is the one inside, the first one, which is already full, just like helium. You see what I'm saying here? Metals become more stable by losing electrons. Nonmetals become more stable by receiving electrons. And this will probably be the final thing I can fit in. This whole idea of losing or receiving electrons brings up the notion of ions. Before, I said that the word atom usually means neutral atom. A neutral atom doesn't have any overall charge because it has the same number of protons and electrons. An ion, on the other hand, is a charged atomic structure because it does have an overall charge. And that's because the number of protons, whatever it is not the same as the number of electrons. When you add up the positives and the negatives, they don't come out to zero if they're not the same number. If you think about this logically, there would be four different ways, logically at least, that you could produce an ion, produce something that has a non-zero charge. Because you have two different kinds of charged particles, right? Protons and electrons. And for each of those, you could either add them or subtract them. So there's four different ways. You could add protons, add electrons, subtract electrons. But only two of those actually take place. Are you blocking the sun? Or? Okay, go ahead. An ion is a charged particle, but I said charged atomic structure. I don't want to say charged atom when I just told you that the word atom means it's not charged, but that's really what it is. An atom that has become charged is an ion. So even though logically it would make sense that you would get an overall charge if you either added protons or subtracted protons, that's not what happens. You don't mess with the number of protons because that changes the kind of element you have, right? It'd be a totally different kind of atom if you messed with the number of protons. Therefore, there's two ways that an atom can become an ion. It can either take on additional electrons, and so now you have more negatives than you have positives. They don't add up to zero. Or you can lose electrons, in which case you still have the same number of protons, but now you don't have enough negatives to counteract them. Once again, it doesn't add up to zero. These two ways that it can happen break the overall set of ions into two possibilities, two categories. If an atom loses an electron, or at least one electron, what is the overall charge that results? No, if it were zero, it wouldn't be an ion. Yes, if you lose electrons, you're losing negatives, right? And therefore, the same number of positives is there as was to begin with. But now you have fewer number of negatives, and therefore the overall charge is positive.
So
And those positively charged ions are called cations.
So what does that do for the element?
It's the same element. It's just an ion of that element rather than an atom of that element.
So is it not considered as pure, or is it considered?
Well, that's not an issue. You can have... It's still an element.
Yeah.
It's just not a neutral atom of that element. It's an ion of that element. If the opposite happens, if electrons are taken on, added to that neutral atom, you're going to have an overall negative charge, right? Because more negatives than positive. And those are called anions. And the point I was trying to make about metals being more empty than full and nonmetals being more full than empty is that it's easier for a metal to lose the small number of outer electrons it has to become stable. And therefore, metals produce positive ions called cations. And nonmetals find it easier to take on additional electrons to fill up the remaining space in their outer shell. So they form negative ions called anions. All right, I'll see you downstairs.